Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
I thought that when I died, I'd see a bright light or float above the ground. Turns out death is pretty mundane. I guess sometimes the end is just the end.
For the last time, Jerry, you're not dead, okay? Now go back to your room.
Jerry has catarrhs or walking corpse syndrome. The guy thinks he's dead even though he's walking around.
That's a clip from the TV show Scrubs. We'll talk about the very real catarrh syndrome and other strange conditions of the self later on in the show. But first, markets jumped out of a plane this morning. The Dow dropped more than 1,000 points before the parachute kicked in. We're now cruising at a slightly more reasonable loss of around 640 points. The cause of this volatility? Well, it's China, or more accurately, an economic slowdown there. And beyond the market histrionics, the Chinese slowdown could have a major effect here in Los Angeles. LA is one of the most popular destinations for Chinese tourists. They spent $1 billion here last year, and Chinese investors have spent many more billions on commercial and residential real estate. So how does the economic malaise in China affect Chinese investment here? Mike Margolis is a partner at the law firm Blank Rome here in L.A. He specializes in Chinese investment in the United States. When I spoke with him earlier, I began by asking for a quick update on what's going on with the Chinese economy.
The stock market's plunged. The currency's been devalued. In fact, the economy is growing slower than probably has even officially been reported. So the Chinese economy going from a developing country to a developed country is slowing down.
And so what does that mean in terms of Chinese investment in, let's say, real estate here in Los Angeles?
It might be counterintuitive, but it means that that kind of investment is going to explode.
Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of money in China that's looking for a home and looking to generate returns. And in China now, the opportunities to generate high returns are much reduced. By some measures, there's over $20 trillion, that's trillion with a T, dollars sitting in bank accounts around China looking for some place to place as an investment.
And Los Angeles real estate looks like a good investment to them?
History shows that it's a favored target for investment, and all the fundamentals suggest that it's only going to be a bigger and bigger recipient of Chinese real estate investment.
So does that mean prices will continue to go up here for homes, condos, office buildings?
I think that's a fair bet.
Okay, so this is good news for investors, maybe not so good if you want to buy a house.
Well, it's true that if you're a first-time buyer, that you'll be facing higher competition. But if you've already got a real estate investment, you own your own home, you're likely to be able to sell it for a considerable gain. So there are pros and cons. But I'd say overall, Chinese real estate investment into Southern California will be one of the great job-creating engines for the next 3 to 5 years at least.
Oh, wow. And so where is it being focused?
In L.A., there's a lot of investment into the San Gabriel Valley, which is, of course, the center of Chinese populations in the Southern California area. But more and more, we're also seeing a lot of investment on the west side. There are Chinese buyers who are closing deals for all cash in the tens of millions.
Wow. This is for residential?
Yes, for residential. Of course, there aren't a lot of houses like that that are going, but it's a sign of how things are going generally. And I would say overall, Chinese buyers tend to go for higher-end properties. If you look at the average cost of a house purchase from international buyers across the U.S., you might be looking at something like $350,000 for a buyer from Canada, maybe $450,000 for a buyer from India. But when you look at a buyer from China, Greater China, that is the mainland, Hong Kong and Taiwan, you're probably looking at almost double that, an average price of over $800,000.
And then also there is investment in downtown skyscrapers.
There is indeed. Right now, as you know, we have two fantastic $1 billion projects in downtown. one being developed by the Greenland Group and the other by Oceanwide.
Aside from real estate, what else are the Chinese investing in here in Los Angeles?
Really anything you can think of. There's industry, factories are being bought, some service industry investments, some biotech, trying to get into some financial services or insurance. Really the whole gamut. 4 years ago, the conventional measure of foreign direct investment into the U.S. from China was about $7.5 billion. And at that time, in 2012, it was only about 2% devoted to real estate and hospitality, hotels. But now in the first half of 2015, there's already $6.5 billion invested, and nearly two-thirds of it is in real estate.
Wow, that is significant. That is quite a shift, from 2% to two-thirds.
Yes, it's a huge shift. I think it's $4.2 billion is the last measure I saw for commercial. And that's not including residential, which is normally not included in conventional measures of foreign direct investment.
So I guess looking at all of this, one wonders, is there going to be a bubble bursting with these ever-climbing real estate prices and with Chinese investment in particular?
It's a legitimate concern, and no one's got a crystal ball on that. Certainly, prices tend to go in cycles. But I think what we're looking at here is the release into the U.S. of a huge pent-up demand for high-quality investment targets. There's so much money built up in China that has been unable to flow out because of China's foreign exchange controls. I think that flow is going to take a long time to be exhausted. Compared to Chinese real estate, for example, U.S. real estate still looks cheap, and appreciation looks like there's no ceiling in sight. Real estate, of course, is one of the Chinese treasured asset classes. So I think we're going to be looking at a great run for a number of years.
So what's the downside?
Well, as you say, when more people want to buy houses, house prices can go up. That may make some housing less affordable. But overall, I'd say there's really not a big downside. It's mostly money coming into the U.S., creating jobs, increasing wealth for everyone.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is when the Chinese decide to reinvest in China or invest elsewhere, what does that mean for projects here in Los Angeles?
I don't think it's likely we're going to see a withdrawal of existing projects. We might after time, again, I'd say we're going to be enjoying this run for at least the next 3 to 5 years. It may be that over time, different geographical areas will be more attractive to Chinese investors, and some of the pent-up pressure of the cash sitting in China that wants to go out and earn a return may have been reduced. So we may see a reduction in the rate of increase, but I think we're going to see an increase in Chinese investment into the U.S. generally for many, many years. And I think Los Angeles is the center of the China-U.S. relationship. So we will always, here in Southern California, have a strong flow of investment.
Mike Margolis is a partner at the law firm Blank Rome here in Los Angeles, where he specializes in Chinese investment in the United States. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Madeline.
And for a closer look at what's going on in China, we've called up Richard McGregor. He's a fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington and author of the book, The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Well, the stock market in China has been declining for the last 6 months or so. What's behind that?
Well, I think it's very important to remember a couple of things about the Chinese stock market. First of all, it's not really a proxy for the economy. It also doesn't reflect, you know, in the way that it does traditionally in Western countries, it doesn't reflect the health of corporate earnings or the health of companies and the like. I think the stock market is really in China is really a barometer of faith in government policy or faith in the sort of stability of the government and the ability of the government to deliver on stated policies. And I think the fall you see in the Chinese stock market now is a reflection of that on a number of levels.
And that's in particular to intervene when the stock market falters, that the Chinese government has been unable to do so?
Well, I think it is related to the economy in this respect. You know, the Chinese economy has rapidly slowed in the past 2 to 3 years. At the same time, of course, the stock market has been going up dramatically, largely because the government thought they could do that to sort of juice the economy a little bit, you know, to give a sort of a consumption effect. And that plainly has not worked. The government intervened, and I think people have lost faith in the intervention of the government. So, you know, it's broadly a sort of erosion of confidence about the ability of the government to continue to deliver high growth and find ways to do that.
And yet, isn't there a lot more investment in the stock market? Aren't a lot more people who previously didn't invest in the market now investing?
Well, yes and no, but it's not really a retail market. I mean, in line with what your previous guest said, you know, the investment opportunities within China are limited because it's not so easy for everybody to get their money out. So you can put it into housing, but there's a bit of a housing bubble. That's a bit dangerous. The housing market in most cities is a bit overbought, so people piled into the stock market. But, you know, if you don't do that, I mean, you can buy bonds, but that's limited. So the number of investment classes in China are limited. And that's why you get that sort of a pronounced bubble effect there.
Mm. Well, do you see many Chinese investors investing elsewhere, overseas?
Undoubtedly. I mean, I think there is a ton of Chinese money which would like to get out. It's not just because of the returns they might get in Western countries, in the United States, in countries like Canada, Australia, and the like, which are the favored investment targets. It's also stability. The ability to get your money in and out of asset classes in those countries. In other words, there's a liquid housing market offshore, there's a liquid stock market and the like. It also is often tied to the kind of insurance policy. If things really get bad in China, you know, if you're setting up shop overseas, you might have a property, you might have a bank account, you might have investments that might in turn help you get a visa. So it's tied up in lots of things. It's a kind of very natural impulse, frankly.
And what about foreign investment into China? Has that slowed as well?
Well, it has slowed a little bit, but that's been taking place for many years. I mean, the big Chinese investment within China is basically Chinese. Second to that is overseas Chinese. So China isn't driven anymore by foreign direct investment. But I think there's one thing on top of that is that it's become much more difficult. Foreign companies were once really welcomed into China and got a step up because they, you know, bought with them valuable technology, products, management experience. Now that China has matured, I think they feel they don't need foreigners like they did once before. And so it's a lot tougher for a lot of companies there now.
Mm. And how does the government play into that in terms of encouraging or not encouraging foreign investment in the country? And how does it, modernize in that way when we do have a truly global economy?
Well, I mean, this is the big, you know, question that China faces right now. I mean, I hesitate to say it. It's a terrible cliche, but China is at a crossroads. In a sense, it is. I mean, the official growth rate is 7%. It's probably much lower than that. You know, it's hard to know exactly what it is, about 5% or something like that. For China, remember, China is still a very low-income economy. It's only about $8,000 per capita compared to, say, $40,000 or so in the U.S. So in theory, China's got lots of room to grow. But they can't grow at the rates they used to. They can't get all that easy growth that they used to have. But they've created, or there is a greater expectation in China now that the good times will continue to roll, or, you know, without being pejorative about it, that the opportunities will be there. But we're seeing, you know, with a pronounced slowdown in growth and, frankly, the inability of the government to soup it up with the old forms of stimulus, then that corrodes, you know, the faith of people in government, and that's very damaging in China.
Mm. Well, tell me, though, what's behind the slowdown in growth? I mean, you said that it's been slow for the last 2 to 3 years, but what's actually causing that?
Well, the vast bulk of the growth of the Chinese economy is investment. In other words, they're building new factories, building roads, bridges, airports, housing, steel mills, all the components that go into construction. I mean, China, for example, consumes two-thirds of the world's iron ore. It consumes about 60% of the world's copper. But at a certain point in time, you know, you can't keep investing money for lower and lower returns. You know, you're simply wasting too much money. Now, this is not news that China's waking up to this. Chinese leaders have been talking for years about moving from an investment model to a consumption model, more like the U.S. in many respects, but they've really struggled to do that.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, the president has been trying to crack down on corruption in the country. How does that impact the economy and its growth?
Well, it affects some specific sectors which don't matter that much. I mean, luxury goods, which corrupt officials used to spend money on, or upmarket restaurants and the like. But it really is an attempt. There's two things to it. President Xi Jinping, you know, and he's also head of the Communist Party, which is a much more important title, I think has really decided that the level of corruption in the party was so great that it was really threatening its viability. Now, corruption has been a problem for a long time in China, but I think he's the first person to really try and do something about it in a concerted fashion. And I think so we've got the biggest anti-corruption campaign in China now since 1949, since the Communist Revolution, the most concerted one. Most people have, you know, everyone sort of expected it to finish, but it keeps on going on and on. That's on one level. On another level, there's always a political element to it, and it's also a way for Xi Jinping to eliminate potential enemies and to consolidate his own power.
Okay, and so let's bring it home. And we saw what happened when the Chinese stock market dropped by more than 8%. Our Dow also dropped by 1,000 points at the opening. And so how worried should U.S. investors be that China's economy is faltering?
Well, you know, the U.S. domestic economy, we shouldn't oversell China's problems affecting that. You know, the U.S. exports to China, I think, are less than 1% of GDP in the U.S. It's the global story, which I think makes investors in Wall Street fearful, because China has a big effect on many parts of the globe. You know, big resource-producing countries, industrial countries like Germany, which are very dependent on China, Japan, South Korea, which are very dependent on China. So it's the way the sort of, you know, China used to take up the slack in the global economy, and that's not going to happen anymore. And that all comes around to bite the U.S. It's not a direct impact. It's a more global impact.
Richard McGregor, fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington and author of The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, speaking of corruption, the president of Guatemala is accused of participating in a far-reaching bribery scam where businesses could avoid paying import taxes. Most of his cabinet has resigned. We'll talk about why that small Latin American country is one of the world's most corrupt next on Press Play.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk about Guatemala now and the extraordinary events there over the weekend. Today, despite pressure to do so, President Otto Perez Molina is refusing to resign. The pressure is coming from tens of thousands of citizens, the nation's most powerful business group, and even the Catholic Church. Much of his cabinet has stepped down and his vice president has been arrested. To find out what's behind this, I'm joined by Michael McDonald of Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us now from Guatemala City. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, nice to have you. And what happened to cause all this anger at the president, and what exactly is he accused of doing?
Right. So there's been sort of public discontent building for several months now, ever since just before the vice president stepped down in May of this year. Prosecutors alleged in April that the government was involved in a pretty serious customs tax fraud scam back in April, and they made several arrests, including the chief, the country's tax chief, who was in charge of tax collection. And the arrests have continued throughout since May, basically, and essentially since May, there have been protests every Saturday and a lot of public anger over this corruption scandal and other corruption scandals that have sort of racked the government. There have been Saturdays where there have been tens of thousands of protesters out. They sort of started to dwindle over the past couple months, but they seem to be fortifying again now that these latest allegations have come to light on Friday. Mm-hmm. So these allegations came up on Friday, and basically what we saw yesterday was the president was forced to give a televised address to address some of these accusations, essentially denying his links to this corruption racket.
Okay, well, describe the corruption racket and how he might be involved.
So it's a very complex structure that has many different levels, but essentially what prosecutors are alleging is that the president and the vice president, who is actually in court today in her first court appearance about the scandal, ran a racket of bribery and corruption in several customs points in the country that involved local businessmen, including vice presidential advisors. Companies would pay bribes to customs officials that would then work their way up the chain of command until they eventually reached allegedly accounts of the vice president and the president.
Wow. And so they could avoid paying import taxes if they paid the bribes. That's the accusation.
Right. So what prosecutors are alleging is that part of this, there are essentially two sets of payments that companies would make when they would ship goods through customs, and one would be to the actual customs agent and to the actual coffers of the state, and then another part of that would be would essentially be bribes that they paid to customs officials that then actually never made it into state coffers.
Hmm. And so, as you say, the vice president stepped down, and I believe she was arrested, right? Is that accurate?
Correct. The vice president was in a hospital last week. She was hospitalized on Wednesday for an illness that she had, and on Friday, Guatemalan authorities arrested her at the hospital. They placed her under arrest at the hospital, and then Friday night they transferred her to a jail. Hmm. This morning she's in court right now, and basically what is going on today is prosecutors are presenting evidence, mostly phone taps and some documents, some checks that were written out to her in court. And so she's there today in her first court appearance over this scandal.
And is she being pressured to testify against the president?
Her testimony will come later. Basically, what they're doing right now are sort of pretrial mm-hmm. proceedings where prosecutors present the evidence and courts decide whether or not the case is going to move forward. So if she does testify, it will be later in the process.
Right, but he has immunity from prosecution, correct?
The president has immunity from prosecution as an elected official. Prosecutors last Friday presented essentially what would be similar to impeachment proceedings. Prosecutors last Friday asked Guatemalan courts to investigate the president, and that's essentially a bid to strip him of his immunity. And if courts rule to investigate the president, then Congress will have to decide whether or not to strip him of his immunity. And if he loses his immunity, he's open to criminal prosecution.
Well, whether or not he's guilty, this scandal has engulfed his entire presidency, and I guess it would make it hard for him to govern. Why doesn't he step down when there will be new elections next month that he can't run in because he's been termed out?
Well, I think that's the concern. I think there's a lot of people in his cabinet that have stepped down. There's a lot of people that think he's lost legitimacy. Why he hasn't stepped down yet, it could be anybody's guess. But pressure is definitely building, and he's lost support from very key sectors in society. He's lost support, like you mentioned, from the Catholic Church. He's lost support from the main business chamber in Guatemala. He's lost some of his top allies in Congress. On Saturday, his education minister stepped down and his economy minister stepped down because they felt like they couldn't be part of the government anymore. And these were his last two ministers that he had, his last two original ministers that were still with him throughout this whole scandal. So he's lost support everywhere. And some people think it's just a matter of time before he steps down. So we'll have to see how this all unfolds in the coming weeks.
Right. Well, describe in general what the state of corruption is in Guatemala, which is a big player in the illicit drug trade. Criminal groups there are very organized. And for many, many years, there essentially was not a criminal justice system. So is this just par for the course, unfortunately, in Guatemala?
Yeah, so I think corruption has been part of Guatemalan politics for decades now. I just think that now it's coming to light. There's an independent prosecutor's body, a United Nations body in Guatemala called the Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, which was installed in 2007. They have a new commissioner that arrived in Guatemala last year, and they had their mandate extended last year. It was supposed to expire in September, but they had it extended until 2015. And they've been sort of a key player in uncovering some of these corruption scandals. You know, I think this is something that has gone on for a long time in Guatemala. There have been questions raised about corruption in customs for years now, for decades really, ever since the 90s and the 80s even. There were accusations of customs rackets, of corruption in customs. So this is something that's been going on for decades, and you know, I think with the help of this UN body, it's finally coming to light.
Right, and to note, the president, I believe, did not favor, President Perez Molina, he did not favor extending the mandate of this UN-backed anti-corruption unit. But
right,
was overruled, but had to extend it under pressure, right?
Right. That was at the beginning of the year. There were a lot of questions about whether or not he would extend it, and I think there was a lot of support for not extending it, actually, in his close circles. I think there were a lot of people that had advised him and that were close to him that said it would be a good idea to not extend it. Then, you know, at the very beginning of the year, they started to release some of the investigations and some of the evidence against state corruption, and that sort of created enough public pressure to extend the mandate.
And meanwhile, what is happening in Guatemala in terms of crime and safety? Because for a long time, this was one of, if not the most dangerous countries in the world.
Sure. So murders have been dropping slightly under the Perez Molina government. There are lots of different organizations and lots of different institutions that have different statistics about the murders. But if you look at some of the official police statistics, they have been dropping slightly. El Salvador and Honduras, which border Guatemala, have higher per capita murder rates than Guatemala, but Guatemala's is still very high. It's still close to 40 murders per 100,000, which, if you look at the global scale of things, is very high. Anything that's, you know, above 10 homicides per 100,000 people is considered a very dangerous country. So, you know, despite the drops, small drops in homicide rates in recent years, it's still a country that's plagued by very high levels of violence and crime.
Okay, and just very quickly, so the new presidential elections begin next month. Is there a reformer amongst the candidates?
It's hard to say. I mean, most of the candidates come from a political background. They've been in politics for a long time. The front runner, there have been questions raised about his alliances with Otto Perez and Otto Perez's Patriot Party, and whether or not you know, he might be involved in corruption. His vice presidential candidate has been accused of participating in a money laundering scandal during his tenure as the central bank president. There were questions raised about Sandra Torres, who is also running close in a tie for second place with another candidate, about corruption under her watch when she was first lady during Álvaro Colom's administration. So it's a reformer candidate. It's hard to really see one.
Yeah. Mike McDonald covers Central America and the Caribbean for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on the program, how do you know what's real and what's not? Whether what you perceive is in fact what everyone else perceives. Up next, a new book on the science of the self. And then there's another zombie show on TV.
Best of all, especially for us, you know, watching in Southern California, it takes place in Los Angeles. We get to see LA yet again destroyed by the apocalypse.
It's the end of the world, after a news update, that is, with Eric Roy.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. So here I am at KCRW Studio in Santa Monica. I'm sitting in my chair. I'm in my studio, Studio 3, or at least I think I am. According to my next guest, it's not that simple that I'm sitting here in my chair in my studio, because all of that depends on my sense of self, which is neurologically much more malleable than you or I might think. Anil Ananthaswamy is an award-winning science journalist, and his newest book is The Man Who Wasn't There: Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Marilyn. My pleasure.
Well, so you interviewed people with all kinds of, are they mental disorders, would you say?
I would not like to call them mental disorders. I think we can just call them conditions.
These are people,
you know, sometimes suffering from different conditions like schizophrenia or Alzheimer's.
Okay. There's one condition that you described that I hadn't heard about, and it's really quite striking. It's called Cotard syndrome.
Yeah.
And this is where a person believes he or she is dead. And it seems that no evidence will convince them otherwise. Can you describe this and how it was first identified?
The condition itself is named after a French doctor, Jules Cotard. I think it was in the late 1800s that he identified a set of symptoms that kind of go together. A few striking symptoms are people might feel as if some organs are missing. Sometimes they'll, you know, I write in the book about some patients who have told their doctors that they're missing their teeth or the uterus. Particular organs can feel like they're missing. But the most striking symptom is this feeling that they have that they don't exist, or like you said, that they're already dead. And no amount of rational debate or discussion with them at that point, when they're suffering, will convince them otherwise. It seems like an unshakable belief, a delusion, but very, very strongly held. It can be treated. Oftentimes it'll last a few weeks and then go away. But while they're in the throes of the condition, they cannot be convinced otherwise in terms of their delusion.
Mm. So there seems to be a less severe condition, and that would be body integrity identity disorder. And I guess that's where people, they don't believe that a body part belongs to them, or they have a problem integrating their mind and their body.
Yeah, so this condition, like you said, it's body integrity identity disorder. It's a condition where people feel like some part of their body, and usually it's part of a leg or an arm, that doesn't feel like their own. And if the person has been feeling like this for a long time, it seems to cause a lot of distress. At least that's the subjective reports you get from people who talk about how it is to be suffering from BIID.
Can this happen to anybody? Can anyone experience these conditions, or are certain people more prone to them?
We don't know. It's a very rare condition. It's not that common, and also it's not really well studied because medicine still doesn't recognize it as a condition that will be diagnosed in a psychiatrist's office. So I think there has to be a lot more done in terms of research to figure out exactly, what percentage of the population do suffer from something like this, and what kind of triggers might be there, how much of it is purely neurological, how much of it may come about through other, for other reasons. So that kind of research hasn't been done, and it needs to be. All we know is that there are people who report feeling this, and then they sometimes will take the extreme action of, amputating that limb.
Hmm. So when you were doing research for this book, and you're not only doing research into conditions that we're more familiar with, like Alzheimer's or schizophrenia, but also these disorders that are pretty rare, which one were you most flummoxed by, were you most surprised by, or that you just couldn't wrap your mind around when you first found out about it?
I think that would be Cotard's. This idea that someone doesn't exist is really, if you're not suffering from that condition, if you're just living a normal life, then one of the strongest feelings we have is of existence, that I exist. That feeling is not in doubt. And I still can't wrap my head around what it might mean to feel like I don't exist. And I think the truth of it for the people suffering is so real, and they're so convinced that one has to accept the fact that that's how they feel. And somehow philosophy and neuroscience has to explain, what does that mean for one to say, I don't exist?
I wonder if you think that, you know, philosophers have been debating these questions for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And if they're kind of ahead of neuroscientists when it comes to these questions and thinking about the concept of selfhood and existence, existentialism, and if neuroscientists have something to learn from philosophers as far back as Plato and Aristotle.
I think both sides have to learn from each other. Philosophers can go out on a limb sometimes, saying things and discussing things that may not have a basis in empirical science. And at the same time, neuroscience can definitely, you know, pay attention to philosophical arguments, because that can give them a framework within which to analyze whatever that they're studying. So I think both sides have to listen to each other, and they are. I think it's fair to say that modern neuroscience and modern cognitive philosophers are working really closely.
Let's talk about another phenomenon that you write about. It's called ecstatic epilepsy. And when I was reading about this, it really made me think of people who have these religious experiences.
Yeah, I mean, ecstatic epilepsy is something that's called a focal epileptic seizure, which means that only a small part of the brain is undergoing that seizure, and the people experiencing the seizure don't fall unconscious. And if you listen to the subjective reports of what it feels like when they're having the seizure, you're absolutely right. It feels as if you're listening to someone describing a mystical experience. And for instance, they will say that time slows down. The seizure may last a second or two at most, but they will feel like a lot more time has passed. They have a sensation of feeling their body and the colors and the sounds much more vividly. They will also talk about feeling like everything around them has been placed perfectly, as if nothing is kind of out of whack. And there's a sense they have of certainty about everything.
Isn't that achieving nirvana?
Nirvana would be a big word. If you look at sort of mystical experiences and how they're explained in terms of why they feel a oneness, one of the things they talk about is that your ego, or your sort of the story in our heads about who we are, the kind of narrative aspect of ourself that is constantly going on. And if you look at what mystics talk about, they're basically saying that you're really, really aware of your body and the bodily states and the sights and the sounds, all the sensations that the body is processing. And somehow this cognitive storytelling that we are indulging in all the time seems to stop. And if that is nirvana, then in some sense, what ecstatic epilepsy seems to bring about is exactly that. Mm-hmm. So the thing that seems to stop is that narrative. So that paradoxical thing of some boundary has gone away.
How many of us actually experience a milder form of these conditions? Is it fairly common?
Yeah, no, I think the reason why I didn't want to call it disorders is I think each one of us is prone to experiencing some of these things, you know, at any given time. And in a sense, it is something that the brain and body can do to us, So something like depersonalization disorder, which I write about, now that's a feeling of being in a state where everything feels like a dream, where you feel disconnected from your own emotions, your surroundings feel unreal, your own body and emotions feel unreal to you. So, and that's a state that if you are severely jet-lagged, for instance, for a day or so, it might feel like that. If you've landed up in a completely new place and have traveled, 12 hours by plane, you may feel like that for a day or so before the jet lag wears off. So it tells you that these experiences are being, our brain and body can create it for us. And it just so happens that in some people, unfortunately, these become chronic and then they become debilitating.
Anil Ananthaswamy's newest book is called The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline. My pleasure.
Well, someone who has a very highly developed sense of self, Warren Olney, is here in the studio with me.
Hello. I hope that's a compliment.
Of course it
is. I'm not sure that it is, but I'll assume that
just
it
take
is.
It.
All right. We decided to take a look at what it must be like to be a police officer now after a year of videos on social media showing policemen killing people, beating people, treating them as if they are the wrong color, mm-hmm. all of that stuff. And we got some very interesting answers from some very progressive police people and from a study of what's going on in and around the country.
Okay, look forward to that. 1 o'clock. To the Point with Warren Olney.
I'll be there.
Great conversations, always there. And coming up on this program, our television segment, we're going to talk about Fear, The Walking Dead, and the new David Simon show on public housing, and whether it stacks up to The Wire. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles is prepared for certain disasters, drought, earthquakes, wildfires, but perhaps not for a zombie apocalypse.
Morning, Los Angeles. Hope you got your flu shot. Reports in 5 states that a strange virus is going around, so if you're not feeling well, go home, take care of yourself.
AMC's new series, Fear the Walking Dead, premiered last night. In it, LA fails to notice a zombie outbreak until it's too late. This is a companion series, a prequel to AMC's hit show, The Walking Dead. And we're going to talk about that and other TV offerings today with Michael Schneider, Chief Content Officer for TV Guide Magazine. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
And Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for the entertainment news website HitFix. Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Fear the Walking Dead, Alan. The premise is same old zombie apocalypse.
Except it's starting out at the start of the apocalypse. And the Walking Dead, Rick goes into a coma before the zombies rise, so he doesn't get to witness all the fun fall of civilization stuff. This is coming straight at that part of it.
And the other thing is, because it's called Fear the Walking Dead, a lot of this first season is really about the fear that erupts and what happens when society starts to fall apart, and rather quickly, slowly the traditional, you know, power goes out and you know, society collapses. And now we actually get to witness it, because in the original Walking Dead, we were cheated out of that. By the time Rick wakes up in the original, it's already happened. He missed the big downfall of civilization. Now we get to watch it. Now we get to see it. And best of all, especially for us, watching in Southern California, it takes place in Los Angeles. We get to see LA yet again destroyed by the apocalypse.
I know. People love to destroy LA.
Yep, apparently,
you know,
so.
And we just need to revive Charlton Heston.
And the other thing that, you know, we've been joking about this one is sort of ground zero for the zombie apocalypse is Silver Lake. So, of course, it's those dirty hipsters yet again.
But they look great, don't
destroying
they?
Destroying civilization.
Alan, what did you think of it?
I had mixed feelings about it. I appreciate the desire. I kind of wanted to see civilization fall too. And I think they're trying to do something, which is go back and actually establish who the characters are before the apocalypse, which has always been a problem on the regular Walking Dead show. But it's kind of mixed. Their idea of interpersonal drama is a bunch of annoying teenage characters, which almost never mix well in this kind of thriller atmosphere. And also, because we're going back to the beginning and we know more than the characters do, there's a lot of people being really stubborn about, oh, there can't be zombies. What are you talking about? And we're going to have to watch them learn all the stuff that we knew 5 years ago. So we'll see how it works out in the long run.
Well, right. And so meanwhile, The Walking Dead itself is starting its 6th season this fall. Are we not over zombies by now?
No, it's still the number one show on television. I mean, it beats almost everything except for football, especially in the adults 18 to 49 demographic. It's huge, and that's big considering it's on a basic cable network. It's not even a broadcast show, and it beats almost everything.
Wow. Okay, so is that all AMC needs then, is 2 zombie shows? And
well, I don't think they're going to stop there, to tell you the truth. I mean, we're waiting to see the numbers for the premiere of Fear the Walking Dead. But honestly, I think they see zombies and the whole Walking Dead franchise as something that they can continue to exploit. And we'll start to see other Walking Dead editions, eventually maybe all 4 corners of the United States.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, let's move on to another corner of the United States. This is Yonkers, and we're going to talk about Show Me a Hero. Last night, HBO aired Parts 3 and 4 of its miniseries, its 6-part miniseries, Show Me a Hero, and let's listen to a clip.
You know, I was a I was against the housing and I won. And now I'm for the housing and I'm getting my ass kicked for it, so maybe I had it come to me. But I think for the first time in my life, I am on the right side of something. And I am all alone. People just want a home, right? I mean, it's the same for everybody.
Alan, this is a miniseries created by David Simon, who did The Wire and Tremé. And how does it stack up, do you think?
I think it's wonderful. It's really, Simon is always sort of America's civics professor, and so he's trying to teach us a lesson here. But when you have Oscar Isaac as the young mayor of Yonkers, the civics lesson goes down really easy. The guy is enormously watchable. And having Paul Haggis, who directed Crash and won the Oscar for that, come in to direct it, it kind of softens some of the sharper and more didactic edges of what Simon does. So it's among the more watchable things he's done, despite the fact that there's not cops and criminals and everything else going on.
Yeah. And is this something, Michael, that people in general want to watch? Something message drama, if you will?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have zombies in it, like we mentioned. It doesn't have superheroes. But I think there's a place for something like this. It's a show for grown-ups. And it's not going to be the highest rated show. It's not the highest rated show on HBO. It's, for a refined taste. But thankfully, there's still room for that. Thankfully, HBO is still doing something like that. Thank God for David Simon for giving us something that's a little different from pretty much, you know, almost anything else on TV right now.
And Alan, this is something, from what I understand, that has been in the works for many, many years. In fact, he had this idea and started working on it before he wrote The Wire.
Yeah, I mean, Lisa Belkin wrote the book that it's based on in the late 90s, and it was in development forever, and he picked it up before The Wire, and it just sort of took until the right moment to make it. And like Mike says, I'm glad HBO is still willing to do this. You could look at the success of Game of Thrones, and they could very easily be justified in saying, we're now only doing big-budget commercial stuff, but they're taking advantage of their great power to have a little civic responsibility as well and do something like this too.
So finally, we've been talking about HBO, which is also home to a new comedy. It's Ballers, about a group of NFL players and agents. But then there's another show on a different cable network, Stars, that we're going to talk about. And I have to confess, I hadn't really heard about it until today. It's called Survivor's Remorse.
Well, it's got a terrible title, which I think is part of the problem, honestly. It's actually critically acclaimed. It's on Stars. It hasn't done as well. By the way, you mentioned Ballers. Ballers did do quite well, but I think Survivor's Remorse for critics is sort of the preferred taste. Wouldn't you agree, Alan?
Yeah, no, I mean, Survivors, they're both sports entourage, but one of them is content to just parade out The Rock and a bunch of NFL players as themselves and not actually tell stories or have jokes. And Survivor's Remorse, which is a bad title and doesn't have a high-profile cast, actually has satire and humor and characterization and a thoughtful look at what it would actually be like to go from nothing to having a small fortune as a professional basketball player.
Okay, so it is about a professional basketball player and his nutty family, and here is a clip.
This is not cool.
You can't be a top-tier pro athlete without doing stuff like this.
Hate hospitals.
Everybody hates hospitals. Come on.
I like any place with room service.
I like any place with underappreciated women.
Then you do this dying kids wishes visit that I didn't know we was doing till now. Y'all told me we was going to a water park.
Look, you drop some jerseys, some kicks, snap a picture with the kid. You at home on your couch by noon.
And funnily or not, this is produced by LeBron James.
Yeah, LeBron James is a producer. Michael Malley is also a producer. Tom Werner, who's one of the sitcom legends, whose company obviously produced Cosby Show, among other things, is also a producer. So it's got great pedigree.
You've got LeBron James as a producer. He's tweeting about it on social media. You would hope that more people would come to it. But because it's a fictionalized sports team and it's not just about the bling and about the lifestyle porn, it's a better show, but it's maybe not as attractive to a wider audience.
Yeah, and I keep going back to that title. I mean, I get the title, Survivor's Remorse. You know, it's about someone who's made it. So, it's sort of the push and pull between the old life and the new life. But nonetheless, that title, Survivor's Remorse, it makes you think that it's something completely different from what it is.
Yeah, you might think it's a David Simon show and it's about something a lot more serious.
Or a spinoff of Survivor, the reality show. I mean, who knows? You could think
yeah,
it's all sorts
about
of weird things.
Hatch's post-prison difficulties, absolutely.
Yes, exactly. Hatch has no remorse.
Well, thanks, you guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for Hit Fix. That's an entertainment news site. And Michael Schneider, chief content officer for TV Guide magazine. And he guest hosts The Business Today on KCRW at 2:30. Hello, Jolie Myers. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Happy Monday morning.
Yeah,
Monday afternoon.
I'm starting to feel a little bit like I have a virus, like brain sounds really good to me. Do you think I should go home?
You just want some lunch.
Actually, a sandwich sounds much better. You're right. So Fear the Walking Dead takes place in Los Angeles. I asked our listeners which shows that they have loved that have taken place here. Mark Roseman tweets that The Shield is his favorite show.
Yes.
I know that you're a big fan of
I'm
that,
a fan
so
of
I thought I'd
show.
Bring it up.
Yes, I love that show.
Also, I know that you're a fan of this one as well. R.C. Langley says The Rockford Files.
Yeah.
That used to be Madeline's ringtone, folks, and it would go off all the time, and everybody would have a dance party to The Rockford Files song.
And then go solve a crime.
That's exactly right. Steve Devil says Lou Grant, with its mythical Los Angeles Tribune, was his favorite. And Nye Cronte says Southland, which is a very underrated cop show. I loved that show, too. I was sad when it went off the air, I think after about one season. Sadness.
That's a bummer.
Right. At least there was no zombie apocalypse.
Okay. Thanks, Jolie Myers. If you want to weigh in on that, we welcome it on Twitter or on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. And Warren Olney is up next at 1 o'clock, so keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.